to find a less stressful life, complete with a warm climate, exotic wildlife, and neighbors who care about their environment, Costa Rica has become a popular vacation and retirement destination. Canadian Nikki Solano married a local man and tells us what it's like living the Pura Vida now with a big extended family.
So usually if we're spending time together, we're either cooking or we're eating or dancing or singing.
For a drier climate, American-born Lucas Peters settled in Morocco more than a decade ago. He shares his favorite things about the atmospheric old-world neighborhoods of Fez and Marrakesh and tells us where you can find some of the best Roman ruins anywhere.
Large, ornate, decorative mosaics still in situ, in the ground, exposed to all the elements, and they've been there for like 2,000 years.
Plus, listeners share their favorite reasons to plan a getaway. Come along for a fun hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Growing up under the flight path for Seattle's International Airport, Lucas Peters dreamed of all the places those airplanes could take him. A bit after college, he left the U.S. for Morocco. Now he and his Moroccan wife are raising a family as he operates a tour and photography business out of Tangier. Lucas tells us about his favorite places to visit in Morocco in just a bit. And listeners share some of the things they like to design their travels around. Let's start today's Travel with Rick Steves with a fresh look at a warm weather getaway, not really that far away, in the middle of Central America. Costa Rica. It's a surf destination, a biodiversity haven, a paradise for adrenaline junkies, and it's nestled between Nicaragua and Panama in the skinniest part of Central America. It's a peaceful mecca for yoga enthusiasts and for adventure seekers alike, wrapped up in a small country about the size of West Virginia. Costa Rica is on two coasts, both the Caribbean and the Pacific. Tour guide and travel writer Nikki Solano became enchanted with Costa Rica 15 years ago. It's where she met her now husband, Ricky, who's a native Tico. Nikki joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves to share how Costa Rica captured her heart with its famously easygoing Pura Vida lifestyle. Nikki, thanks for being here.
Hi, Rick. Thanks so much for having me.
So it's the Nikki and Ricky show in the Tico country.
People get a kick out of that we're Nikki and Ricky. I swear we didn't plan it that way.
And Tico, is that the nickname for people from Costa Rica?
Yes. Yeah, so if you identify with male, then you're a Tico. And if you identify with female, then you're a Tika.
There you go. Hey, tell us how you met your husband. Because you're from Canada and he's a Tico.
He is. He's born and raised Costa Rican. The most proudest Tico that I've ever come across in my travels. So I met him about 15 years ago on a whitewater rafting tour down Costa Rica's famous Pecuari River.
What a souvenir.
I don't know if I've ever told anybody this, but I tipped him $20 and I say that was the best $20 that I've ever spent.
15 years ago in Costa Rica, that's probably a pretty good tip.
You know, I was a lone backpacker and I searched around seeing if anybody could break that 20 for a while.
Yeah.
And they couldn't. So.
Well, that's a tip right there. When you're going to countries that have a lot of tipping and that are not that expensive, you got to break those big bills.
Absolutely.
And otherwise, you're going to do a lot of $20 tips when maybe you didn't want to quite spend that much money. Hey, what's special for you, other than Ricky, about Costa Rica? Because thumbing through your Moon guidebook to Costa Rica, it's so clear you love Costa Rica. What is it about Costa Rica, other than Ricky, that stole your heart?
Yeah, I mean, there's two things. Well, there's a lot of things I love about Costa Rica, but there's two main things. The first I'd say that I fell in love with right away was that Pura Vida lifestyle. So just that relaxed, laid back, love life, love the simple small things philosophy. So that kind of hit me right away. And then I'd say probably within the past maybe 5, 6, 7 years, I've grown to love how much Costa Ricans love their country. And this mm-hmm. comes through a lot in the sustainability initiatives that a lot of people are taking on. So they recognize that their country is beautiful and needs protection, and they're doing a lot to try to conserve it.
You know, when I think of Central America, I think of civil strife and war-torn countries and abusive governments and harsh colonialism and banana republics and imperialism and difficulties that, to be honest, are still a big problem in most countries in Central America. And I always wonder how Costa Rica kind of missed out on all that heartache. And my hunch is it was less interesting for the original conquistadors and less interesting for big American corporations that wanted all those bananas. Does that make any sense to you? Or why, if you go back 100 years, was there all that interest in the other countries and Costa Rica didn't get colonized to the same degree?
Yeah, that's a good question, Rick. I don't know if I've ever really given it much thought. I don't know. I mean, Costa Rica was, it had a lot to offer. If we go back 100 years, I mean, coffee was becoming a very important crop. It's kind of took over the nation a little bit. That's why they call it the golden bean. So I don't know. I'm not quite sure why it wouldn't have been as attractive.
Well, it's just a real blessed country, that's for sure, any way you look at it. And I'm always fascinated by talking with other guidebook writers because we're usually doing work when we're in the country that we like so much because we really care about our guidebooks. And clearly, when I look through the Moon Guidebook on Costa Rica, you've put your heart and soul into that book. But when you're vacationing in Costa Rica, where do you go to get away from the responsibilities of listing all the hotels and the tour guides? Where do you go just to hang out with Ricky?
Yeah, so we usually escape to off-the-beaten-path locales because, like you said, when we're working, we're always kind of checking out those hotels and popular beach areas. So we tend to escape to more remote areas. We really like spots on the Osa Peninsula, which is quite remote. We also like a spot called San Gerardo de Dota, which is a small little non-touristy town up in the mountains.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of great bird watching up there, a lot of great nature reserves that you can check out.
So there is an interesting notion of just, you want to have a beach vacation, but if you missed the high country, you'd be missing a big important slice and part of the charm of Costa Rica.
You'd be missing a lot. Yeah, I mean, for Costa Rica vacations, it's quite common for people to visit 2 to 3 different destinations during their trip. So I always recommend save the beach for last.
Uh-huh.
and select at least 2 places either in the mountains or just in an inland region to get a lot of that wildlife, a lot of the culture, a lot of the adventure activities.
This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we are talking with Nikki Solano, who writes the Moon Guidebook to Costa Rica. Her website is nikkisolano.com. That's Nikki with 2 Ks, N-I-K-K-I. And what I would like to talk about, Nikki, now is this sort of unique, I would say, lifestyle, and that's Pura Vida. I love that song, Don't Worry, Be Happy. I would imagine that could be the national anthem of Costa Rica. Tell us about Pura Vida.
Yeah, so Pura Vida translates to pure life in English, but it's not so much about living purely. It's just about living simply and being kind of comfortable with not a lot of things, trying to live life without a lot of stress, making sure you take time to spend with family and friends, and more recently, taking time to do what you can to protect the nature around you and make sure that Costa Rica is around for many years to come.
Boy, I think if ever environmentalism and conservation was a practical investment, it would be in the case of Costa Rica. Because I know in other countries in Central America, they've had government buy international corporations that really have no concern for the sustainability of some dimension of the environment, especially natural parks and so on, and they're paying the price today. And Costa Rica sees the natural environment as a resource to be protected.
And also a great source of income through tourism.
Yeah.
So sustainable tourism is very big in Costa Rica right now. And we see it in 2 different ways. The government's doing a lot in terms of enacting these programs to try to protect the land, but also just individuals around the country, business owners, hotel owners, restaurant owners, they're doing what they can within their own business practices to try to, you know, protect the land around them and keep it beautiful.
It's a kind of enlightenment, I would think. So back to Pura Vida, I love to go to a country where one word kind of fits it all if you're in a good mood. And Pura Vida can be used if you're a traveler in Costa Rica. What are the uses of the word or the phrase Pura Vida?
Sure. So you can use Pura Vida almost any time that you're trying to say something that has a positive tone. So if somebody asks you a question and you want to answer positively, you can say Pura Vida. So for instance, Rick, if you said, hey, how's this interview going? I could say it's Pura Vida.
Ah, good.
If somebody, you know, asks how you're feeling, you can respond Pura Vida. So you can just kind of incorporate it throughout your language, even if you don't speak Spanish. Muttering a quick Pura Vida to a Costa Rican is a great thing to do on vacation.
So if I'm on a beach and some salesman's trying to sell me something and I'm not in the mood to buy anything, I could say, no gracias, Pura Vida.
That's exactly what I would say. No gracias, Pura Vida.
And that's like, no thanks, but life is good. Carry on.
That's exactly right. And he'll be thinking, okay, I didn't make a sale, but
Pura Vida. And in Spain, you know, it's just great to say hola or hasta luego. And the same thing, Pura Vida.
Same thing, Pura Vida.
Yeah. And when things go wrong, your luggage is lost at the airport,
No, Pura Vida. No, we only usually say Pura Vida when we're referring to something positive.
Okay, I got it. Now, when you think broader cultural terms about this Pura Vida lifestyle, there's a focus on family and friends in Costa Rica, I would imagine. And tell us a little bit about, because you're married into the culture, basically, hanging out with the family, choosing to do a family time rather than a lot of TV, or how does that work?
Traditionally, Latino families are quite large. My husband's family is absolutely no exception. He has upwards of 100 cousins, so it's quite a lot. Usually when we get together as a family, there's a lot of people, a lot of loud music, some karaoke, and tons of really great homemade Costa Rican food. So usually if we're spending time together, we're either cooking or we're eating or dancing or singing.
You're a tour guide, and when you mentioned food, I just thought, yes, because one of my favorite things to do lately is take a food tour. I don't know if you do food tours or not, but if you were going to take me on a little adventure experiencing 4 or 5 special taste treats in Costa Rica, what would we do together? What would we eat?
Well, there's two things that you will eat pretty much every single day, no matter where you travel. So for breakfast, Ticos always eat something called gallo pinto, which is a white rice and typically black bean blend. They have that every day for breakfast, so you'll get that no matter where you are. For lunch or for dinner, they serve something called casado, which is typically rice and beans again on the plate with a protein, so either a fish, a chicken, or a beef, and lots of sides. So popular side options are mixed vegetables, sometimes patacones, which are smashed and fried plantains, a slice of fried cheese, or a home-cooked tortilla. And then for the really great food, you have to go to the Caribbean coast because you get a lot of those really rich Caribbean-inspired plates. So that's where you'll find your coconut rice and beans, jerk chicken, again, patacones, and lots of really good food made with love.
Oh, made with love. Made with love. A Pura Vida approach. And you know, when you think of the tourism industry, talk just a bit about surfing. And I know yoga always comes up when I hear people talking about Costa Rica.
Yeah, so yoga and surf are very popular activities, mainly on the Pacific coast, but you can also access them on the Caribbean coast as well. And they tend to go hand in hand. So a lot of places that offer surf retreats or surf lessons will also offer yoga retreats and yoga classes. So if you're interested in surf and yoga, you can either come to Costa Rica on an all-inclusive retreat, or if you already have some experience, you can pick a beach town and pretty much anywhere you go, you can get a yoga class or a surf lesson. And kind of do it on your own.
Nikki Solano, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your passion and your love of Costa Rica. Congratulations on your guidebook, The Moon Guidebook to Costa Rica. And I hope to see you sometime down in Pura Vida country. Best wishes.
Thanks, Rick. Pura Vida.
Nikki Solano and her husband Ricky run the CostaRicaTravelBlog.com. She also writes the Moon Costa Rica Guidebook and offers a month-by-month guide for Costa Rica trip planning at NikkiSolano.com. A fellow guidebook author joins us next with a look at his favorite places to explore in his home base of Morocco. It's Travel with Rick Steves. It's hard not to be dazzled by Morocco, from Atlantic beach resorts to Saharan oasis towns, mountain peaks to lively medieval medinas. There are so many facets to that country. But when you go to Morocco, what I think is Fez and Marrakesh, two amazing cities, cities with a rich history, cities with a fascinating labyrinthine medina, cities with so much cultural excitement to offer. And to learn more about these two great cities and to learn more about traveling in Morocco, we're joined by Lucas Peters. Lucas writes the Moon Guidebooks to Morocco, and Lucas, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on, Rick.
So when you think about Morocco, there is a lot going on. And you've got, of course, a variety. Just before we dive into Fez and Marrakesh, let's think about beach resorts. You've got Atlantic beach resorts.
And Mediterranean beach resorts.
Mediterranean. And you've got the capital city, Rabat. You've got Casablanca, which we all know and have a romantic image of from the movie. But frankly, Casablanca is not much if you have limited time.
No, it's a real economic hub, very modern city, not a lot of history there.
And if you're coming in from Spain, you've got that just 45 minutes away from a ferry ride from southern Spain. Hourly ferries cost $40. Just flash your passport, buy a ticket, and bam, within an hour you're in Morocco. You've got Tangier. That's where you live. And that's a great place to go. But the dominant two cities are Fez and Marrakesh. What is it about those two cities that makes them such a cultural wonderland?
Well, you know, they both have their own unique charm, but what's similar with them is they're both very old cities. You know, they've both been established over 1,000 years ago, and that history's maintained. And I believe that is perhaps the one link, you know, where you touch that old sort of Arab world here in Morocco.
And it does survive, doesn't it? Because I was just in Tangier, where I was meeting up with you a couple months ago, and I had this romantic notion that we'd find all of these beautiful bits of old traditional commerce alive, you know, the neighborhood bath, the communal oven, the place where people go to make a phone call. That was 10 years ago or more. And now most of that has been swept aside as things have become more affluent and more modern. But Fez and Marrakesh have these massive medinas where there's no cars, and it seems like traditions survive more in that shady, aromatic, misty, confusing wonderland. Do these traditions survive in Fez and Marrakesh?
In Fez, more so than Marrakesh in a way, because Marrakesh, it is, you do have cars going through there. Now, there are neighborhoods in Marrakesh where you still have communal ovens and you still have the public bath, the hammam. But in Fez, because it isn't able to be reached by cars in the Medina, just the roads are too narrow and windy. So because of this, in fact, they still maintain, you know, you still have everything from your communal oven to your phone, you know, the internet cafe, you know, still alive and well.
You still have that. Yeah, because when you think about it, in the old days, people just wanted a roof over their head. They didn't really have plumbing. They didn't necessarily have an oven. They didn't have a shower. And they just expected to wrap a towel around them, put on their slippers, and go down the street to the neighborhood bath, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that was for a lot of people, that's still the way, particularly in Fez. You know, there's still people that do, you know, the public bath. That's what you do 2 or 3 times a week.
And in your book, you write about how Fez has perhaps the largest car-free urban area in the entire world. It's quite a statement.
So as far as we know, because of how Fez is laid out, there's about 125,000 people that live there. And the Medina itself cannot be penetrated by automobiles. So you won't find scooters, motorcycles, cars, but you will find donkeys, mules, horses, carting goods and services up and down those Medina streets.
You know, I love that. When you were just painting that little picture, I have many, many vivid memories of almost being run down by old-fashioned ox carts. And, you know, they have these big lumbering wheels, these classic, like we think of in a cowboy western, with the wooden spokes and the heavy iron rims. And they just rattle down these streets with all of their watermelons or honeydew melons on them. And you just kind of throw yourself up against a wall so you don't get bumped by them. And it's just, you get sort of caught up in the rumble, tumble, crazy energy of the whole scene. And one thing I always think about when I'm in a Medina is like a medieval marketplace, right?
Yeah, it's just a medieval city. Medina literally just a city. That's literally the translation, yeah.
Because it was within those walls because it needed the safety and it's got that very dense footprint. But it's overwhelming because there's no way to know where you are. And for me as a tourist who doesn't speak Arabic, I just know by altitude. I come in at the gate. There's gates. Those are landmarks all around the wall. So you come in at the top gate, the highest gate, and then I just don't try to stay found. I get as lost as I can. And when I want to find my way back to where I was, I keep going uphill. Does that work for you or a tourist?
That still works for me. No matter how many times I go to Fez, I'm still eternally, you know, if Rome is the eternal city, Fez is the eternal city of being lost.
Now, when we do travel in places like Fez, anywhere in Morocco, I've found there's two cities. You've got that medieval Medina, but then, of course, you have the French colonial period, right? And that's a city with an entirely different character.
Yeah, like all of the major cities in Morocco will have the old Medina, which is just the old city. And then right next to it, you'll have a colonial city. In the middle of the country, that's French. In the north, that'll be Spanish.
Yeah. So you've got, in a lot of cases, art deco architecture, and that's where you'll find the modern businesses and probably people that are more into modern commerce with, you know, more language skills and women not wearing, you know, scarves and covered up quite as much, more progressive, modern.
And that's where you'll find your McDonald's and the Starbucks. But of course, at the same time, you also find the train stations usually too, which is handy for us to know.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Lucas Peters. He's joining us from Tangier in Morocco right now to talk about the two greatest cities in his country, Fez and Marrakesh. You can connect with Lucas and his work by searching for Journey Beyond Travel, that's Lucas's tour company, on Facebook, on Instagram, and on YouTube. And you can find his website at journeybeyondtravel.com. Lucas, when we're in Fez, one thing surprising to me is a little side trip where you can see some of the best Roman ruins from anywhere in the ancient Roman Empire. Can you tell us about that side trip and what's so special about it?
Yeah, just about an hour outside of Fez, you can get to Volubilis, which was the former Roman capital of this region for about a couple hundred years. And yeah, like you said, it's one of the best preserved Roman ruins you're going to find around the Mediterranean. Complete. And what the thing I find fascinating about this, they have mosaics, like large, ornate, decorative mosaics still in situ, in the ground, exposed to all the elements. And they've been there for like 2,000 years.
I was there a while ago, and I'll tell you, I expect to see Roman ruins near the coast or, you know, accessible to all the trade. This is in what seems like the middle of nowhere today. It's just in a vast open area, and it's incredibly well preserved. It's got to be one of the finest and most underrated, unheralded examples of Roman splendor, 2,000 years old.
I'd have to agree with that. I mean, I was just in Rome a couple weeks ago, and I was in my head comparing this to Volubilis, and I was thinking, well, I mean, they got the Colosseum, but Volubilis is pretty good too, yeah.
Well, I guess the reminder is if you're going to Morocco, I know you're not thinking ancient Rome, but when you do go to Morocco, if you're lucky enough to go to Fez, give yourself the better part of a day to take the side trip. It's just a short drive outside of the city and check out Volubilis. Now, also, actually, your tour company is putting together my tour for Morocco when I go back in a couple of months. And I noticed you dedicated an entire day while in Fez to side tripping into the mountains for waterfalls and caves. That was the one big surprise on the itinerary you proposed to me. And I'm excited about this. Tell us about the side trip from Fez into the mountains.
Well, from Fez, it's a really short drive to get up into the Middle Atlas Mountains, where you'll be in the world's largest cedar forest, where the resident macaque monkeys will make you feel very welcome. And these are the same monkeys, interestingly enough, that are in Gibraltar as well, because this was all part of that same mountain chain there.
I know them well, by the way, because they almost they grabbed my bag when I was on top of the rock of Gibraltar, those monkeys. And in my bag, stupidly, was my passport. And this smart aleck little bugger of a monkey had my bag in his hand, and he looked at me as if he knew my passport was in the bag. And I was lucky to get it back.
You'll be up in this area, and this is where I spent my first 6 years in Morocco, was in these mountains, in this forest, living in a little village up there. And from there, you'll be going to Bahlil, where they still have troglodytes homes, like these cave homes that people still live in. One of them I think you can find on Airbnb, actually. But it makes for a really interesting sort of excursion, especially when you couple it with another village we'll stop by the name of Sefru, which is great to see artisans still practicing their crafts. Outside of kind of the hustle and bustle of Fez, because Fez can get pretty busy. So it's nice to go to a little bit quieter place.
I love the opportunity, because we are inclined to go to big cities, big famous cities, but to splice in some small towns and some rural cultural sites, and that's what we'll get when we side trip outside of Fez. When you talk about those artisan activities, one thing I am so enamored with in Morocco especially is those traditional activities, all that craftsmanship. And I got to say, I'm a little bit nervous because of all the prosperity and the modernity that's come along, and you find Starbucks on corners where you didn't used to have Starbucks. The traditional crafts, do they survive still in the depth of the Medina in Fez? When I went there as a kid in the tannery, you had to hold mint leaves against your nose so you wouldn't get disgusted by the smell of the dyeing of leather.
Yeah, in short, yes, they all still survive, including the tanneries where, especially in the warm months, you want to keep the mint handy to put in your nostrils because the smell is quite pungent. Yeah, there still is a job for, it's usually for young boys where they go around scooping pigeon poop up to help cure the leather. So just when he thought it was pungent, it gets even worse.
So if you've got a nice leather coat from Morocco, you got to thank the pigeons and the poop.
Absolutely.
No, what's behind what you buy.
Lucas Peters is our guest on Travel with Rick Steves. He designs custom tours of Morocco through his company Journey Beyond Travel from his home base in Tangier. He's also the author and photographer for the Moon Guidebooks to Morocco and Marrakesh and for Grand European Journeys. His personal website has information about the Moroccan guidebooks he's written. It's at lucasmpeters.com. You know, one of my favorite things to do when I'm in a great city like Fez or Marrakesh is to sit in a cafe and just watch the world go by. When I sit in a cafe, I do notice, to be honest, it's almost always men. What is the story about women and their position in modern society these days in Morocco? Because you can't help but notice out in the streets, it's a man's world.
Yeah, you know, especially in traditional Morocco, you know, when we're talking about the old Medinas and Casbahs, the norms would be, you know, the public sphere is for men, the private sphere is for women. So in a lot of the guest houses, for instance, you might see a more female staff, whereas in the cafes, you know, which are outside, you might see just more men. Now, when we're in Fez and Marrakesh, that'll be mixed up a lot because tourists are very welcomed in all the cafes. Moroccans are very hospitable. So, you know, for the ladies listening in.
So a tourist woman could be, absolutely, if she sees a cafe, which is nearly all men, they could go in and join the scene. They might not like the fact that it's so male-dominated, but that's kind of the way it is in public. But you're saying in private, it's more of the woman's domain.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. And uh-huh. It's probably a good note here to say that my wife is prone to going into whatever cafe she feels like going into, and she's a Moroccan woman, so...
So she makes a point because she's a modern, well-educated Moroccan woman, and the cafe is for everybody equally, of course.
Yeah.
And now we're going to go to Marrakesh. And I got to say, this is such a touristy thing, but if you're taking the train to Marrakesh, if you're a boomer like me, let's say you're catching that train from Casablanca to Marrakesh, you got to sing the old hippie anthem by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, the Marrakesh Express. I think I was on my first trip there in the 70s, and I remember leaning out the window of that train, just jostling along 20 miles an hour on a train, the Marrakesh Express. Morocco has fast trains now, don't they? I mean, if you're going to sing Marrakesh Express, it's probably an air-conditioned interior.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But you're going to get to Morocco anyways, and the trains and the buses, long-distance taxis, hire a car and a driver. One way or another, you're going to get around Morocco. Coming into Marrakesh, boy, oh boy, what a city. It's first of all, it's got all sorts of nicknames. Tell us about the nicknames and where they come from.
So the most popular nickname is just the shortening of the name. We call it Kesh. Some people like to say it's cash. So as in they'll take all your cash. But the other popular ones are the Pink City, the Red City, the Ochre City. And this has to do with the iron-rich soil from around there that they're actually building up the city with. So all the city walls, I mean, which there's, I think it's something like 14, 15 miles of city walls that surround the old city that are all built up with this, you know, reddish hue.
I remember being there and thinking, the Red City, what's the big deal? And then I was on the main square and it was at sunset and that red brick wall just lights up as it has for centuries. I was standing on that square, which is really the cultural highlight of the city. What's the name of the big square? It's just like a carnival of activity.
Yeah, the Jemaa el Fna.
Jemaa el Fna. And what are you likely to see, Lucas, when you wander around that square as a visitor?
I like to think of it as the world's longest continuous running circus. It's been going on for 1,000 years. You'll see everything from monkey handlers and snake charmers to storytellers and musicians and acrobats and fortune tellers. I mean, they're all there.
Now, a lot of this is tribes, people from the countryside, Berbers and so on, coming in for the big market. Is that right? And then, you know, they'll hang out and they'll have their entertainment.
Yeah, historically, you know, that's what it is. But it's really just it's become a place of entertainment over the last few hundred years. So it's not necessarily just, you know, the tribesmen coming in anymore. Now, storytellers, that's a job for somebody. And the people gathering and listening to storytellers are locals and local tourists as well. So you'll have Moroccans traveling to Marrakesh, as Marrakesh is just as popular of a city for us as it is for Moroccans.
Lucas, what do you say if somebody says, that sounds redundant, Fez and Marrakesh? Shouldn't I just spend time in one city and then go to one of the resorts on the Atlantic or go up into the mountains? How are Fez and Marrakesh distinct?
So for me, Fez is unique in the way that it is the world's largest pedestrian-only zone. It is a place you can only walk around. There's a quietness to it. With all the hustle and bustle, it's a surprisingly quiet sort of city because you don't have the zooming scooters and cars and stuff. So there's a kind of quietness that I think lends itself to on-foot exploration. Now, Marrakesh has been developed over 1,000 years of being a trading hub. So it has everything. You know, if you want to do hot air balloons or motorcycles, or you want to, you know, go rock climbing, or, you know, like you just want to take a carriage ride, you know, like it has everything there. Like Marrakesh has been developed to where like it is a spot for people to go to for that kind of luxurious Riyadh, you know, that Moroccan guest house experience. I mean, Marrakesh, you're just spoiled for options there. You know, one's more of a getting out on the city, exploring it on your own 2 feet. And the other one, Marrakesh, is going to be more like find a couple things that you really want to do. Experiences, particular experiences that you really want to have.
If we could just finish off with you giving me a quick language lesson. What 2 or 3 words should I know before my next trip to Morocco?
You have to know Salam Alaikum. That's peace be with you. That's the common greeting. Salam Alaikum.
Salam Alaikum. Okay.
Afek.
Afek, what is that?
Please.
Please. Afek. That's a good word, and I can remember that. Salam alaikum. Afek.
Shokran.
Shokran. Now, I remember that as a kid as sugaran. There's sugar. I want sugar on my cake. Shokran.
Shokran. Thank you.
Shokran. Well, Lucas, shokran for a beautiful experience talking about Morocco. Happy travels.
Hey, shokran, Rick.
You can listen to earlier conversations we had with Lucas about his life in Tangier and with Nikki Solano about living in Costa Rica. That was on Travel with Rick Steves, program number 724, and it's in our show archives from 2023. We have a link with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Up next, we're checking in with listeners for examples of interesting ways to frame our next travel adventures. We're at 877-333-RICK. Sometimes listeners to Travel with Rick Steves will write us a few lines about what's made their latest travels feel special. Some of the most intriguing travel reports often seem to follow a thread, as people use their hobbies and special interests to help them design a tailor-made itinerary. Let's check in with some of you now to hear how your own passions and pursuits have brought you memorable adventures in faraway places. Our number is 877-333-7425. Our email is radio@ricksteves.com. Anthony's on the phone from Eugene in Oregon. Hey, Anthony, thanks for your call.
Hello, Rick. It's so great to talk with you.
Yeah. What hobby have you factored into your travels?
Food.
Food. There we go.
Our family very much travels on our stomachs.
I think that's a good way to travel.
That's been our take as well. And plus, my wife and I travel with our 2 kids. We have a 9-year-old daughter, a 12-year-old son. So with our kids especially, we find that when we can tie in food, tie in cooking classes, it's hands-on, we're laughing, we're doing this activity together. Anything we've done around our interests in food and cooking's become just some of our favorite memories from our trips.
And especially you're talking about with a family of four, you got kids that are 9 and 12. What a great way to create memories, huh? And then you come home and when you cook that again, it takes you back to those travel memories.
Exactly. And all the other things around it, like we were recently in Morocco, we took a baking class on making different Moroccan cookies.
Mm.
And we finished out the day on the rooftop at the place where we took the class. We're looking out over the Fez Medina, a place that's been there for 1,000 years, drinking our Moroccan tea, eating our cookies, and talking about what we had just done together.
I was just there in a class where we learned to cook in a tangine.
Yes.
That was fun. I wish I had my kids with us, but they're a little old to travel with their parents now.
Well, you know, but at the same time, you as a father as well know just how much those experiences build into your kids.
Oh.
Even if they're younger, and maybe some of those memories aren't as direct, it's still part of them.
Absolutely. And you have the experience in your travels, but you also carry that home, and then you have added an extra dimension to your family cuisine. You know you've got that. You can have a better appreciation of that Moroccan cooking or the Thai cooking or whatever.
That's what we like to think of. This really hit home for us actually many years ago when our son was a toddler. We went to Japan for 3 weeks with him, and he doesn't remember that. He was 15 months old. He could barely walk. However, Japanese food is his favorite.
Ah, there you go. Well, in my younger days, I did a lot of traveling in Japan. It's my favorite country to eat in. And I remember coming home, and I was kind of evangelical about Japanese cuisine before it was widely available in the United States. And my family just didn't get it. It was so frustrating. I kept inviting them over for a Rick-cooked Japanese meal. And maybe it was my cooking. It's probably my cooking, but it just never worked. And I just thought, I'm going to give this up. I got to go back to Japan and enjoy that beautiful, beautiful cuisine that is so different and distinct from other countries.
Then I think we must have picked up the torch from you, because we have certainly been running with our own evangelizing Japanese food, Thai food, Moroccan food, you name it.
Hey, Anthony, what's your experience with food tours in your travels?
You know, one of the things we love, especially nowadays, when you can do so much vetting online with reviews, with different services on the internet, we find that makes it so much easier to hone in on not only what is a good match from a culinary perspective, but what also looks like it'll be a good match for someone who can work well with our kids.
Yeah. So if you've got kids of 9 and 12, you probably want to go through a market and munch a little here and munch a little there rather than sit down for a long time.
Precisely. That was one of the things we really appreciated with the cookie class in Morocco. It was very clear from the reviews. They were very experienced. They'd worked with a huge age range of travelers, families, seniors, you name it. And it was exactly that. Our hosts had a wonderful pace. They took us out into the market. They were like giving the kids bits of spices and herbs and blends that they could sniff and sample. Yeah. And it just brought everything right down to their level.
I love it. And that's for kids of all ages, because it's not a qualitative thing. It's a stylistic thing. You know, you can have equally good $100 food tours that take 3 or 4 hours. And one would be visiting 3 restaurants and sitting down and really gaining an appreciation of something that is gourmet. And the other would be visiting 8 little hole-in-the-walls and talking to 8 different artisans who are just really enthusiastic about what they do. And that's the kind of food tour that I favor. And I've found that I'm inclined to do a food tour wherever I go.
That has become one of our go-tos as well. Prior to Fez, we were in Tangier. And we did a walking tour around that area that was centered on a bit of food sampling. One of my fondest memories, our guide took us to this little side street in one of the neighborhoods we were walking through. And there was a place there serving I'm going to mess up the name off the top of my head. There was the basara. It's like that bean soup that's a very common breakfast food.
Oh, yeah.
So we're standing there. The kids are having a bowl. We're having a bowl. We're chatting with folks who, you know, they just come in every day. They get their soup. They talk about the day. And we had that moment of being right there with them, and our kids are understanding, hey, here's just another way people get their day underway.
That is such a great experience for your kids. Anthony, so much fun.
And the people take such pride
in
their food ways there. So when they can tell that you are also appreciating it, respecting it, curious about it, it opens so many doors.
It's beautiful. Anthony, thank you for opening this door to all of us who are listening and thinking about ways we can splice that unusual hobby of enjoying local food on the road. That's something we all have in common, I think. So thanks again, Anthony. Take care and happy travels.
Thank you, Rick. Take care.
Bye. And Scott's on the line from Reno in Nevada. Scott, thanks for your call.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, we're talking hobbies as they apply to our travels. How does that relate to your travels?
Well, the last couple of trips to Europe, my family and I have built our vacations around races. In particular, I'm a cyclist and triathlete, and I especially like to do Ironman triathlons. And there are some very fun ones at some great locations in Europe. So, for example, our first trip, I raced Ironman France, which was in Nice in the south of France.
Okay, wait a minute, Scott. You said it's such fun. Tell us what an Ironman race is, for those of us who don't know three parts of it.
An Ironman race is a long-distance triathlon that starts with a 2.4-mile swim, then a 112-mile bike ride, and then a full marathon, 26.2 miles.
And a full marathon after after all of that. Aren't you exhausted by the time you get to the thing that's supposed to exhaust you?
I usually am. Yeah, it's most people who run marathons don't warm up first with a long swim and a bike ride. But
isn't that
what I like to do?
Okay, so that's the standard structure of an Ironman, and that is a competition that's put on all over the world. And you let that be a target for your travels, and you have to sign up for these things in advance. How does that work?
Oh yeah, very far in advance, and then a lot of training beforehand.
Yeah,
too, trying to balance work and family around that.
Okay, so now take us on the road to actually do this Ironman. What's it like? What do you do?
A lot of logistics, first of all, trying to ship a bike over and then get all the nutrition, the gear. But then also we try and build some fun things for our kids around them. One trip I raced Ironman France, which was in Nice. But we started that trip in Paris and then went down to Nice. And we had some fun day trips around that. So before the race, for example, we took a fun day trip to Monaco with our kids, which was not too far on the train. Saw the Oceanographic Museum, the palace, the cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
And then after, we went back to Paris, and the kids had a great time around that. But in the meantime, they got to enjoy all the sights of Nice, the beaches,
nice.
And all the culture there.
Now, you know, you are going over there on a triathlon, and you're swimming and biking and running. What about just biking with the family? I mean, I've always thought biking really connects you in a way that a lot of people don't appreciate.
It does. In fact, 2 years ago, my wife and I went to Bordeaux, and we actually just rented bikes, just casually, recreational cycling through the vineyards around there. And it was a great way to see the terrain, to see the different parts of that part of France.
Hmm.
And it was nice to do it in a casual way without burning out my body at that time.
Hey, I bet it's a little different than being in an Ironman race. But when you're biking through Burgundy, my experience in biking through wine regions is there are these service roads in the middle of the vineyards that go for miles. And it's a delightful, delightful way to bike without being concerned about, you know, big trucks and this sort of thing.
Yeah, it was terrific to do that. We found the same thing. We actually did some tours as well where there were some local tour guides who took us on bike tours.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go to different vineyards and learn about different types of grape varieties. And before that, I would never look at a vineyard and think, okay, that's a Cabernet Sauvignon grape. But now I can do that.
You know, when you think about doing these Ironman races, how does the experience vary from country to country? Do you see, you know, in the Mediterranean countries, people are a little more easygoing, and in Germany, it's a little more, snap to it. Does that come across in the way the races are designed and the way the races are completed?
I think it does. I found the experience, for example, in the south of France was much different than racing in Frankfurt, Germany. Frankfurt, Germany, everything was dialed in, and the logistics, I think, were a little bit easier there.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I found that, you know, the relaxing culture in the south of France probably a little more enjoyable.
When you get done with a long day of biking in France, I would imagine you really appreciate the cuisine.
Absolutely. And even in Germany as well, because the day after I did the Ironman European Championship in Frankfurt, we drove down to Bavaria, and I ate quite a hearty meal in the town of Füssen.
I just love that. I mean, when I hike in the Alps, there's something about your ability to appreciate good basic food and wine after hiking all day. And it's part of it is just the fresh air and the appreciation of the natural glory. And of course, another part of it is just you've been working up an appetite all day. But there's something about it. It's just one of the great delights of travel.
It absolutely is. Last summer, actually, we were in Lauterbrunnen Valley in Switzerland.
Yeah.
And my son and I did a 5K run through the valley. But we got back to town into Lauterbrunnen and enjoyed just such a great breakfast. And it was hearty. And I think being outdoors while we were eating it,
yeah,
seeing the beautiful sights of that valley, the waterfalls, it was captivating.
Oh, yeah. Scott, thanks so much for calling and thanks for sharing. And I can just picture you with your family enjoying all these cultures, eating all this great food, and then, what, 2.4 miles swimming? How many miles biking?
112 miles.
112 miles biking and then, what, 36 miles running.
Full marathon.
You must be an animal.
Just trying to inspire my kids.
Nice. Well, happy travels and best wishes in your next race.
Thanks so much, Rick.
Take care. Bye, Scott.
Bye.
We're comparing notes on how we can splice our hobbies and our interests into our travels to make our travels more fun. Our phone number is 877-333-7425, and you can email us at radio@ricksteves.com. And Clara in Loveland, Ohio, did just that. Clara writes, "We arrange our European travels around festivals. We scheduled our trip to Barcelona in 2012 around a music festival. Little did we know, my husband was going to propose on that trip. For our honeymoon, we scheduled it around the Galway Seafood Festival and enjoyed a lively parade through the streets and a gourmet seafood dinner. And for our next trip, we're taking it to the live music festival in Lisbon. It's a great way to see how the locals party." Wow, Clara, what a great, great tradition you've got going there. Proposals, honeymoon, next trip dreams, all around different festivals. And it makes a lot of sense. Everybody's in a good mood when these towns are having their festival. Sally is on the line from Lavelle in Pennsylvania. Hey, Sally.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for calling in. How have you put your hobbies or interests into your travels?
Well, when I was a child in rural Pennsylvania, I had this fantasy of being a sheep herder in Wales with images of rolling green hills and flowering meadows and wonderful sheep and playing a flute. Oh. So I always had this inside as I grew and kept opportunities open in life.
Uh-huh.
And so while I was traveling in Europe in 2015, an opportunity arose to assist a farm woman in Swaledale in the Yorkshire Dales.
Huh.
So I moved into her ancient cottage and slept in the sitting room with a coal fireplace and manned all the fires of her ancient stone cottage in a small little hamlet called Low Row. In the late winter and March winds and March showers, it was an opportunity to experience life in a hidden away gem of a dale and learn many new things.
Wow, that sounds like a very real experience to live through the winter and the darkness and the early nights.
Yes, I had so many interesting opportunities living life with the local people in a time of year, as you say, that wouldn't normally be a time somebody
right.
would necessarily make their way to the windy, wet north. In fact, I never ran into another American on this journey and never saw any tourists. Instead, I found myself with the geese, and my first day as I walked to feed the Angora goats in the barn, simultaneously, these two male geese caught me by surprise from behind, digging their teeth into the back of my legs.
Oh, no.
And stopped me in my tracks effectively. Little did I know that their mate's first egg had been laid in the barn near the goat. So
oh.
they had good cause, but it was not quite the welcome I expected to the Yorkshire Dales.
When I hear about your desire, your dream of being a shepherdess, I think of Le Petit Hameau. Did you ever go to that place at Versailles? The Queen, Marie Antoinette, dreamed of just having a simple life in a pastoral setting like you're dreaming about, and she created this little hamlet for the peasants. And, of course, she had her perfumed sheep and her manicured gardens. But she had that back-to-basics experience, and it sounds like you didn't do that with perfumed sheep. You did that with the real thing.
Yes, and in terms of the shepherding, I was put in charge of four little lambs that were considered extras. So I became the four times a day bottle feeder and mother to these precious little lambs, witnessing their first steps and their frolics and leaps of joy. And the favorite would just fall asleep in my arms within the first minute. But then I did have to leave them, and I knew that farming and it wasn't all about the warm fuzzies and that these dear little lambs would only have a few months of life before becoming someone's dinner. And that actually cured me of my, you know, I honestly am grateful that I took this opportunity, because I would not always wonder whether I should pursue sheep herding, because it wasn't quite the romantic reality.
No.
And there's a lot of hard things there. But I really appreciated the opportunity to experience that and to work beside a woman who never left that little hamlet and who was stooped over from hard labor, but in a place where there was good people and good community that's rare to find in our current age.
And you learned the hard reality of being a shepherdess who falls in love with her sheep.
And I actually sobbed my way for hours from Yorkshire Dales down to my next assignment in the north coast of Devon. And it was pretty devastating to leave the little lambs that I had fallen in love with. But that's really what travel's all about, is giving yourself wholly to experiencing the magic and memories.
Well, Sally, thank you very much for sharing. And I think we can all aspire to have that kind of experience. I just think that is so rich. Thanks again, and happy travels.
Thank you, Rick.
Take care.
Those far away places where the strange sounding names calling, calling.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton, Kazmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Our theme music was written and performed by Jerry Frank. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio.
Hey, Rick Steves here. In 1978, I was a 23-year-old piano teacher dreaming of the fabled hippie trail from Istanbul to Kathmandu. With my buddy Gene, we booked the tickets, packed our rucksacks, and set out on the adventure of a lifetime. My new book, On the Hippie Trail, features my 60,000-word journal and vivid photos of my coming-of-age trip. Squeeze into rickshaws, sail the sacred Ganges, and look into the eyes of the Virgin Goddess as you stow away with me on the legendary Hippie Trail. You can pre-order my book, On the Hippie Trail, right now by following the link at ricksteves.com. And if you do, I'll send you a postcard with access to special bonus content.